You're listening to a special edition of the Culturefile Debate, recorded live at the Kirkos Space in Dublin with the Shortwave Orchestra. Over.
Welcome to the Culturefile Debate, which is coming to you this time from the Kirkos Space in Dublin 1. And we're in front of a live-ish audience who've just watched a trio of trios of electronic musicians responding to the sounds of shortwave radio, some of which you'll have just heard if you're listening at home instead of here in Little Green Street, a lot of which you'll have heard if you're in the room. There is somebody in the room, is there?
Yes.
You'd never make it at a panto. There is somebody in the room, isn't there?
Yes!
I thought there was. I thought I detected something. Anyway, our panel, or possibly modular rack, are some of those who brought the noises, along with the person who brought the shortwaves, who is Mike Harding. So I'm going to introduce our panel, but I wanted you to tell us what is or was on the table in front of you for the last hour or so for that trio of trios. So our first guest is Brian O'Connell. Brian also creates music as well as being a drummer, and also creates contemporary dance. He's worked in film and theatre and even silent film, in which he teamed up with Eric Friedlander. Hello, Brian.
Hi, Luke.
What have you got in front of you there?
I have three drums and a cymbal that I didn't really use.
That's the non-electronic bit of what we've just heard then.
Yeah.
So, and also with us is Aileen Wallace, who is a multi-instrumentalist, producer and sound designer, who, when not bending circuits with Bloop Group and other modular sororities, performs experimental electronic music under the name Last Eden. Aileen also performed this evening along with the next module in our rack. But before we get to that, tell us, and what have you got on the table in front of you, Aileen?
That's a great question.
I did set you up.
You did. At any given opportunity, of course, I love to talk about the Pulsar 23. It's an incredible piece of machinery. I absolutely love it. It's so versatile and fun and can produce anything from hardcore industrial techno beats to utterly, completely bizarre sounds. So paired with that is this wonderful pedal called the Outer Limits by Parasit Studio, which is an independent one-person pedal builder out of Sweden who just happened to make, I think, three, maybe four of these, and I found the last one and absolutely fell in love with it. So I think that is a must-have. And the Earthquaker Devices Ghost Echo, which is just an absolutely beautiful reverb and does exactly what it says on the tin, you know, digital ghosts.
I have to give people maybe a little bit of the visuals. It is like as though you flayed a porcupine and stretched it over a shoebox. It's got lots of pointy bits sticking out. And I have to say, a very beautiful curly telephone cable in shocking pink.
Yes.
That really makes the brings the drapes together. And also in our modular rack is Dennis McNulty, a not so former musician, it turns out, from the evidence of this evening. Currently artist, module maker and researcher working across cross-disciplinary collaboration. Dennis performed earlier with Aileen. Hello, Dennis. What were you performing on?
So I had two pieces of equipment I was using. One was a kind of small modular system, which is a rack that can, you know, you place a bunch of different modules into it and then you patch them together to do whatever, you know, make whatever sounds, rhythms, whatever you want. And then I had a smaller device called the Music Thing Modular Workshop System. And it comes as a kit and you solder bits of it together. And it's just a bunch of just kind of basic elements that you would use to make synthesized sound. So two oscillators, two filters, two slope generators, a mixer, and a few other bits and bobs.
So the sort of things you have lying around your house, basically.
Yeah, like if you went into the garden shed, you know, they'd just be there staring back at you.
Yeah. We've used all the buzzwords now. We've got patch, we've got module, and we've got solder. So we kind of know the space we're in. But actually, Mike Harding, who is the instigator of the shortwave orchestra, you didn't have a bristling porcupine in front of you. What did you in front of you, Mike?
No, I had a laptop. I know, the boring one. But the thing about shortwave is occupies a lot of listening hours before you can hunt down sounds that you like. So I had some pre-recorded files, which I've been using for a while on various other formats. But years and years and years of listening to shortwave, and it pays. It's a dedicated task, but it's very rewarding, and you finally can isolate the pulses and rhythms and textures that you want. So I had pre-recorded files, and the live element was using web SDR. The University of Twente in Holland very kindly provide a very clean platform.
We'll get on to the University of Twente in a minute. For those of you who don't know Mike, and that would be a shame, Mike is the instigator of Touch, which is a label that it puts out music and it does a lot more besides. Mike, as I said, is the instigator of the shortwave orchestra that's brought all these people together. And why an orchestra? That seems like almost the last word I would use to describe this little aggregation of circuits.
Well,
and modules.
It's pretty lonely on your own. But it clearly is an orchestra using non-conventional instrumentation, of course. But the idea is to use local talent available. And Brian gathered the names together because I know a couple of them, but Aileen I'd never met before, and Dennis the same. So I was very much in his hands. And
this is a world premiere that we've had here.
It's the first time I've done it.
Yeah,
in this format. Yeah.
So what's the fascination with short waves? What are short waves and what's your relationship with them?
Well, for some reason that I never found out, but my parents, when I was about 14, gave me a beautiful beast, a shortwave radio. Lafayette HA800. It's a fantastic machine and very old-fashioned with, you know, proper dials and things, and a pair of headphones. And I don't know what they imagined I would do with this, but I found over time that I was more interested in listening to things going on in between the stations that were broadcasting, you know, stuff. It was quite fun finding BBC Radio 4 for the first time, you know, from an aerial, you know, on the roof attached to my great thing there. But it was actually, I got more and more interested in the sounds between the stations. And that sort of developed and the way I listen. And I think it's an evolving journey that, you know, that you can go through yourself, and it just increases the way and changes the way that you listen to the outside world, and has stood me in very good stead for working with field recordings, which came along much later. So that's where it started.
It has a particular relationship with modular synthesis, or the synthesized music we're hearing, in that you're talking there about your early days with a radio set. You're kind of out there hunter-gathering. It's not that you pick up an instrument and it has a set of sounds. You're finding brand new textures between the stations of the shortwave, I guess.
Yes, and they're never constant. When you say hunter-gatherer, your prey is never in the same place, you know, twice. It's constantly shifting about and changing, and that's part of the challenge and fun of hunting it down.
And I guess, Dennis, am I right, do you think, in saying that has a relationship with what's happening with these modular synthesizers, that, you know, you have to go and find things that maybe are out there in some platonic level, but, you know, they're not pre-canned sounds, they're not even traditional sounds.
Mm. I mean, in some sense, a tradition has evolved over the last kind of 50 or 60 years, so there are certain sounds that people make with synthesizers that are now kind of traditional synthesizer sounds.
Go on, can you make that sound? That's what I was wondering. Can a human do this? Like a beatbox does something similar. So, what's a traditional synthesizer sound?
The traditional sound is the filter sweep is like the classic, you know? So it's like...
That was actually really good. Aidan, can you do a filter sweep? This is the Baroque period of filter sweeps. Yeah, but anyway, there is still an element of, it's not all cat. Yeah, there may be cliches within the colour textures, but the reason, I guess, you're all still interested in it is there are new things to be found, uncovered.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of innovation in terms of the people who are making the modules. It's for the most part like a totally kind of grassroots scene. And most of the manufacturers are one or two people working in a shed somewhere. So there's no commercial imperative, really. Nobody, like very few people make money from it. So what you get is people who just want to try things out, you know. And it's a very experimental zone in the best kind of sense of the word. So people are experimenting with ways of making sounds, ways of organizing sounds, experimenting with interface as well. There's a lot of really innovative designs in terms of how you might interact with the thing.
There's a really strong community, though, with modular synth, isn't there?
Yeah, it's huge. And it's really kind of, I guess, facilitated by the web, you know. So there are a lot of tools that people use on the web for like planning things out and finding each other as well, you know. So, yeah.
And I guess from the way you talk about it, that has a sort of political import as well. You know, you use the words that are good, like community and grassroots, like, and that's not automatically what people think about when they talk about circuits and electronic technology. And we're always sort of saying, oh, you know, that these chips were first used in the defense industry and the internet is a defense tool. Mm. So somehow there's a resistance to that in this, or is there?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. Like, I mean, one thing about modular synthesizers is they're quite expensive, you know, so there's almost immediately a kind of sorting mechanism there, you know. But then there are people who are, like, there's a huge DIY scene. So people buy things as kits and they're actually quite cheap, and they solder up their own bits and bobs and kind of innovate in that way. So there are ways into it that are kind of like more reasonable or cheaper or whatever. But I think, in a sense, what happens is you kind of shift from the idea of a finished piece of music, and it's actually much more about the process of making it. So I think it's actually closer to something like mindfulness, you know, like that people play with modular synthesizers because they want to be in a particular state of mind.
Aileen, is that bringing you towards modular synthesizers?
Yeah, I mean, just listening to what you've been saying really resonates with me as well, because I come from an improvised background where nothing is constant. And that's a point you made as well, Mike. So for me, it's very natural to explore something. And what I love about hardware is that I feel like I'm interacting with it as I would a quote unquote traditional instrument. And it opens up different pathways when you're open to something being impermanent. You know, like when you create a patch, you change one thing, that patch is gone forever.
Just unpack patch a tiny bit for people who might not get that one.
So in the modular world...
I'm not going to stop you to explain every single part of the game, but...
So, I mean, I can give like a very simple example with the Pulsar, that if I want to take a clock, which basically is a measure of time... So
Aileen has picked up a purple cord, which has a little clip on the
alligator
end.
Clip. So the way this machine works, that you don't have a traditional patch point, which is like a mini jack, which on modular systems, that's how you'd patch things together. With the Pulsar, you beautifully described as like a porcupine in a shoebox. I think that's quite okay. But
thanks.
So whether it's a modulation source or a clock, or which is a, you know, a time division, so you might have your 1, 2, 3, 4, you can patch that into places. And basically, it's sending control voltage and electrical signals around the system. And it can even, like, it's weird. Like, it's difficult to explain because it's amorphous in a way. You know, it's hard to make things completely constant. Like, yes, you can have something very on the time in the pocket, but you can also have something that's completely expansive, and you can push the boundaries and you can push conventions with any bit of hardware if you're just willing to explore. You know, and you can bring yourself into, which I think is a very good point that you made about mindfulness. You can lose yourself interacting with a piece of hardware or machine, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, the device you have there, which is called a Soma Pulsar 23. I mean, I've been talking to you about that. And when you talk about it, you have a very kind of embodied, very personal relationship with it. It's not just like a piece of gear you got.
Yeah.
Tell us that has a good sort of history as well. I mean, that's what sort of Dennis is saying, that there is a kind of like, there is a little star fraternity of people who are good at making modules, maybe.
Yeah, Soma Laboratory, the founder and the brains behind all of these really interested pieces of equipment is Vad Kramer. And he has a crazy engineering background, but also a musician, and wanted to bring the two worlds together. So everything that Soma designs, he's coined it organismic. You know, so the machine should almost feel like an organism. And a lot of their pieces of hardware operate in that way where, you know, you have touch pads and you become part of the connection.
And tell us about the touch pads.
So we have a touch pad. It's just beautiful, right? It just sounds amazing. Like,
I mean, can you just, you know, the sweep? Can you tell me what the components of that little thing we just heard? What was happening?
So this is divided in four units. You have a bass drum module, a bass or a percussion.
That's the thing that's quite confusing here. This is a drum machine, but actually, drum machines are the best thing for producing interesting noises. Rather
absolutely,
than drums.
Yeah, because the range is quite broad. So it can do a number of things.
I feel that we've been leaving the drum machine that we had with us tonight out of this. Brian,
please.
Aileen was saying one of the nice things that you get with these machines is a kind of randomness, a kind of resistance of getting in the pocket too much. I mean, I think you're supplying that yourself. I think that's a compliment rather than an insult, is it?
I have no problem with the randomness. I have a very disorganized brain. So there's a lot of ways this could go. But I suppose what I like in terms of what Aileen is talking about is when I can organize myself, and that feels good. So when I'm listening to sounds around me, like from David and Anthony earlier on and Mike, I was able to extract some kind of grid or something like that from it.
Grid?
Yeah. I mean, a rhythm is a way of organizing time. And that to me is a way you communicate how you feel about what's happening at that exact moment and repeat the moment because you've committed to it. And that communicates to other people. And to me, that feels
you know, like I listened to a lot of Fela Kuti. There was a great documentary about Fela Kuti recently, and it went into great detail about repetition. That happens to be the thing I'm obsessed with. So I'm going the opposite direction in some ways to this. Mm-hmm. The cause is very random, but the result is the opposite.
Yeah, I mean, I was feeling, I don't know, again, I'm never sure whether these things are a compliment or not.
Here we go.
I was feeling like there was a lot of German drumming in there. There was in this first session, we were having a little krautrock backbeat happening.
Yeah, I mean...
Is that an insult first?
No, not
Let's
at all.
Let's get that out of the way.
I am really obsessed with Yaki Liebezeit, the drummer from Cannes, and his work over the last 20, 30 years of his life. And... he kind of liberated drum playing from kind of some kind of a juggling exercise or pat your head and rub your tummy exercise into something that was nothing but musical. And I'm very much into that. Yeah, it's a way of structuring things. I like structure.
It's something that combines very interestingly with this stuff, which is freer and is more stochastic. I had a big debate with Dennis earlier about the different flavours of randomness. So you have a taxonomy of randomness, which was completely new to me, Dennis. What is random?
Yeah, what is random? That's a philosophical question, I guess, probably. But, you know,
that's the way to take it anyway.
Yeah. I mean, people use terms like indeterminate or stochastic or random, undefined maybe. And each of those things, they kind of relate to similar ideas, but they all actually mean something specific, you know. And some terms, they have a kind of general meaning, but then they also have a specific technical meaning in certain contexts as well. So
which of those terms was most present in what we heard this evening then, do you think?
That's a good question. Yeah, that you've got me stumped. Sorry.
By a good question, you mean unanswerable.
Yeah, I think it's very difficult to generalize, actually, because everybody was kind of working to their own, you know, logic, I guess. You know, I mean, we were trying to kind of channel Mike's vision in a way. But also, I suppose when people incorporate, let's say, randomness, for want of a better word, you know, in terms of like with modular systems, it's very easy to patch something up that kind of does things that you're not expecting, you know, to some extent, or it'll create a rhythm that's irregular in a way that you could never predict. But I mean, the main reason to do that is that there's something for you to push against or something for you to kind of interact with, you know. So it becomes a kind of part, it's a kind of another player in a way, you know. So there's a kind of friction that emerges in that relationship, and that's something that actually is intensely enjoyable a lot of the time, you know. But it's this feeling of steering something as opposed to directing exactly what something is.
But interesting, coming back to Dennis about there's no director, so I'm not standing there with a baton. Suggesting when people start or stop or fade in, fade out, or whatever it is, you know, I'm absolutely very much relying on everyone listening to each other and contributing to the group in that way. So it is steering rather than directing.
Just tell us what the process for this, you know, bringing these people together with. You gave them material to think about?
Well,
or
slightly reluctantly. I just really had a skeleton file for everybody, which had a beginning and an end. And I just said, please just respect the beginning and the end. And what happens in the middle, let's just unpack slowly, you know, between us. And I did share some files because it was more helpful to than not, basically, for the whole process. But generally speaking, I was slightly reluctant to share rather than overloading suggestions, which would then predetermine what they did. I was worried about doing that.
But I guess you do want to flavour it. That's why you provide something in this context.
Yeah, but they all knew enough about vision, you called it. Heavens above, what a crazy word. Vision. Idea, suggestion.
Yeah.
Suggestion, let's say, that I had. And they all fed into that because they've all got lots of experience and prior knowledge of working with sounds like this. So I felt in incredibly safe hands.
So tell us, you know, you had a beginning and you had an end. What was in the middle there then?
Well, I have no idea. Was there anything in the middle?
The fact that we've all sat down to work this out.
But again, you see, what I knew from it's from Trust is that when I left them alone to their own devices, they would more than respond in a way that I could then maybe come back at them and that they would challenge me. And the one thing I said to everybody individually was less is more. In a space this size, with an audience this size, do not overload the systems with sound. You keep using the word noise, and I object to that word very much so.
Otto,
it's like calling plants you don't like weeds. It's just not on. They're plants, and you know.
Well, I think
you don't need them at the time.
You may have a terribly colonial view of noise.
Now look here.
The politics of this space is something I wanted to talk about a little, because here we are sort of decoding the music that can happen here, with the randomness of it, the grid. But the fact that this space exists and that this sort of music, if that's the word we have to use, although noise is just as good, if this can happen here,
sound.
that's kind of miraculous. And I wonder with your experience with touch, you know, making this kind of music available around the world, are you feeling that these kind of spaces, this kind of endeavor and event, are getting quashed in some way?
Yeah, there's immense pressure on the whole system. I mean, when we started in the 80s, it was pretty straightforward to put a show on. I mean, there were tons of churches who you could just turn up, and not turn up on the day, but organize something reasonably soon. You had the press there to promote it. You had the scene, if you like, to respond to it and turn up, and massive amounts of curiosity and energy. And you could go to, you know, gigs like this on a really regular basis. It was people who had to lug all their heavy equipment, because in those days everything was heavy and bulky, but parking was easier. So it was, you know, generally all round there was just less pressure on the system. So now it's exactly the opposite. Everything's expensive, difficult, you know, there's a lot of obstructions in the way, property developers not least. You know, it's just getting harder and harder and harder. So somewhere like this is a godsend, you know.
Aileen, I mean, do you find that same sort of pressure? I know you play with Bloop Group, and also I think you've been involved with Dublin Modular. Like, there are these places where things can happen. Do you find that's something that's under an expansion, or are you feeling what Mike is feeling, that there was a time?
Yeah, I think, like, definitely the scene is...
Tell us about Bloop Group, by the way, before you... Yeah.
Bloop Group?
Yeah,
is there anyone here from Bloop Group?
Yeah. There's a couple of
There's
them.
There's a few yeah. bloopers in the crowd. Bloop Group is a wonderful community of modular synthesizer enthusiasts.
That makes it sound like fishing or something, isn't it? Angling.
Wow.
Can be a little bit fishing, I suppose. But Bloop Group was started by Caroline Soares and Gary Byrne just about over a year ago now, yeah? Just over a year ago. And they've basically just created a community for people who are like-minded to come together, because it is very lonely when you're on your own in a space doing what you do, because there isn't spaces for one. You know, there aren't venues willing to take a risk on something that's experimental. In fact, whenever you call a venue and you want to put on a show and you use the word experimental, they're almost a bit reluctant to kind of give you the space or give you the night. Or
Have you thought any good words that will do for experimental? I'm always looking for them. I want experimental, but I want a nicer word for it.
I mean, when you find one, please let me know and I will happily use your term.
But anyway, I mean, that's one group, and there are others. But I wonder what that means in terms of the sense that there is a community, that there are people who are working together. You know, tell us a little bit about that.
Honestly, it feels really amazing to be part of something like that. It's something that I've lacked in various other cities that I've lived in, where there's been kind of experimental groups or spaces, but you've often kind of found yourself pointy elbows, pointy shoulders in some degree. It can be quite clicky, or the community has already established itself and there isn't an openness for expansion. You know, certainly I found anyway, because I straddle the lines of experimentalism and Fluxus, and I come from a completely different background. So I guess I've always been on the outside of the experimental scene as well, and have had moments where I've participated in it. But having something like Bloop Group or Dublin Modular or something similar, where it's about community, it's about events, it's about working together, connecting people. You know, it isn't a typical kind of networking event where you feel like you have to go and sell yourself. It's a genuine community of people who get together once a month with shared passion and shared interest. Everyone is willing to share knowledge, which is just phenomenal, you know, and you get to learn so much about other pieces of equipment as well, and maybe find yourself spending loads of money that you probably shouldn't spend on really expensive modules because you tried out one time and you go, I have to have that.
Yeah, but money has to come into it, doesn't it? I think of this intersection with architecture. Like, we're sitting on this crossroads in north central Dublin, and around us in the past year or so have risen skyscrapers which tower above the Hacienda, which is this sort of famous late-night pub where people roll into it. And across the road from where we're sitting, through the grid of windows, we can see a beautiful red brick building that looks endangered, it looks preyed upon. I wonder, Dennis, about this sort of intersection of architecture and cultural viability.
Yeah, well, I guess like just a little bit further down the road at the crossroads where the Lewis crosses over is the former site of the complex, which was an incredibly significant venue, incredible gallery program, visual art program, studio spaces for artists. There was a smaller venue that was a lot of jazz and improvised music there. Whole communities were just completely shattered when it closed down earlier on this year. There was a protest movement to try and save it, but it didn't work out. The landlords want to sell the building, the site, so that it can be developed. So, yeah, it's really, I mean, it's just, this seems like this endless struggle for artists and musicians and creative people in the city. On the one hand, you know, the powers that be say that Irish culture is so significant and it's, you know, brand Ireland, and they're so concerned with exporting Irish culture to the rest of the world. And the reality on the ground is that, like, artists just have to struggle. Like, it's a daily grind to just actually make things be alive, you know, exist as an artist. So so that kind of disconnect is just quite kind of, I don't know, when it's kind of prolonged, it makes it very difficult. Yeah. But I mean, the thing is, in the face of all of this, there is community, you know, and there are people who are really seriously committed to what they're doing, and they find ways to kind of circumvent these things and continue. You know, I mean, as an artist, I feel like the most important thing is how do you continue? How do you keep going? You know,
Mike, how do you keep going?
Yeah, indeed. Well, you know, we're not too far away from property is theft, are we, in these terms that we're talking about? And community goes completely against the whole capitalist notion of divide and rule and exploit to the maximum impact. I prefer resources to money because it's also time. It's all sorts of other things that you've got in your arsenal that you can use. But I mean, if you go back to, again, the 80s when we started, the UK had housing benefit, and there are tons and tons and tons of indie bands, hugely influential now, who only could do what they did, rehearsal time, recording, because they could get a part-time job and be in a band for the rest of the time and learn their craft. And that's so much harder now. And that's where I kind of think I was lucky to be in the part of the generation that benefited from that. Now, housing benefit got removed in the 1990s by a Tory government. Okay, to them, it's completely illogical to support an independent art scene. It doesn't make any sense to them.
The interesting thing is that on the face of it, and, you know, in the coverage in The Guardian, Ireland has a better situation than you might imagine because we've had this basic income for the arts scheme. Brian, I'm to bring you back in there. Has that been useful in kind of providing the kind of supports that Mike is talking about that you used to have in pre-Thatcherite Britain? Not you, from obviously, not you personally.
For me, it was, I mean, very close to a lifesaver. I had not been, I have a lot of struggles to take myself seriously as any kind of a contributor to this kind of thing. But once I got used to having this money and nobody forcing me to
you got the scheme, yeah.
Yeah, I was the recipient of it for 3.5 years, which was just, I mean, unbelievable. Like, there's a lot of jiggery-pokery about what the criteria were for applying, and a lot of people aren't very happy with how it was doled out. But it was a pilot scheme, and for better or for worse, 2,000 people got it, and I was one of them. And
Just pause you for one second. Yeah. Can I just check in the room here? Anybody else lucky enough with Brian in the room with us tonight? One, one, that doesn't seem like it's penetrating very deeply into the community, does it? Sorry, Brian.
Yeah, so what it enabled me to do was, you know, I had literally no excuse not to work on the thing I really like doing, and had, it's very hard to justify it if there's no money coming in. You can't, I couldn't do it for so long. And it was like probably a year and a half into it before I began to be able to take that seriously. And I've reconnected. It has allowed me to reconnect. What occurred to me when everybody else was talking about this stuff is that we're looking at some very significant individuals in here who have individually created communities. Anthony and David, Dennis, Mike, yourself. Gavin Pryor is at the back there, or he was earlier on. I don't know if he's still there. Like, these people are... There always has to be one person or two people doing all of the work, regardless of how egalitarian philosophy is. People take roles and they play their parts in a scene. And if there weren't, like I said, these people are very significant for the way music is perceived in Dublin and internationally, in a very small but very significant way. And it's very meaningful to people like me.
So, I mean, we're going to run out of time in a minute, but I wanted to get to the community, to the people on the floor. We have the radio mic. Anthony Kelly, who has actually one of the most fabulous tables. And it's actually where the porcupine idea comes from. You have a beautifully crafted wooden box, sprouting, I would say, wires, which are sort of, even as we're sitting here now, wafting gently in the breeze.
It is definitely, yes, yes. I'd love to be able to say that I made this myself, but I didn't. I bought it about 15 years ago from a company called Folktech. They're an American company. I'm not sure if they're around anymore, but it's an instrument that I just keep coming back to it. You know, it gives me so much.
Is it by any chance plugged in? I want to see what happens when you stroke the grass.
I think of it as old man's nasal hair.
So that's one of the heavier strings.
But yes, it's fantastic. It sort of does away with, like, it collapses the visual hierarchy, because that's a tiny little filament and it sounds like an elephant.
So there's also a very sensitive metal surface, probably has contact mics underneath it. But it allows you to do all sorts of really,
for the people at home,
delicate sounds.
Anthony's now moving a tiny trowel over the box and doing a little bit of pruning. Also playing tonight was Kevin Brew. Kevin, you have a semi-invisible setup there. I see a Mac Mini and a keyboard largely. What's going on?
Well, I managed to get an awful lot of online shopping done while I was doing the gig. But when I wasn't doing that, when I closed those windows, I just was using Ableton and a kind of a chain I set up in Ableton, which is almost too conventional for such a beautifully experimental, groundbreaking ensemble. But I was collaborating with my friend Sy Schroeder, and he was working with his MPC, and he had an incredible sound coming from a kind of a slowed down Glacier Rhodes that was playing, making its way through a sample all the way through the performance. It sounded great.
And how did that dovetail with the politics of the occasion?
I don't know. I was able to forget all about politics for the first 20 minutes of this week. It's been very oppressive space, and it's brilliant to come here and be in a kind of a utopia or a community of electro-minded people, and with the audience and with each other. Like, it is a kind of a little electro-utopia we have here.
I think the very fact that it happened is the point.
Absolutely.
It's the political
Absolutely.
Point, isn't it?
So that's all we've got time for this time on the Culture File debate. We're going to pull the plug on the Shortwave Orchestra, and because there are a lot of plugs involved, that's going to take quite some time. I want to thank our audience here in Little Green Street in the Kirkos space for coming along this evening, and also our panel, Brian O'Connell, Aileen Wallace, Mike Harding and Dennis McNulty, as well, of course, as the rest of the Shortwave Orchestra. Culture File will be back next week at very approximately this time. Until then, bye now.